You're listening to Mac Talk on the All Warrior Radio Network. To covering Hendrix. Yeah, here on All Marine Radio. Joining me is a Marine that I met in 1989 or 90 and walked into Combat Town with his hands in his pockets. I said, "Hey, Lieutenant, get your hands out of your pockets." And he said, "Sir, I'm going to be a captain pretty soon, and I'm supposed to help you." I'm like, "Good God, what have they sent me? What in the hell have they sent me?" Joining me is Major General Paul Kennedy. General, first of all, good morning. Thanks for doing this. How are you?
Hey, Matt, good morning. So I already know how this is going to go when you're spinning those tails. I did have my hands in my pockets,
yes.
But you were wearing some sort of a field toga, and so it's a bad place to throw rocks from.
Yeah, but you don't understand. I don't care. It was a functional toga. And I was not a man to be trifled with at that point in my career, because I think I was already on the off ramp. So we wrote an article that still is read today called "Why Does a First Fire Team Rush?" Based on our experiences teaching squad tactics, and we worked on a lot of decision making stuff very early in the stages of the Marine Corps, I think, teaching, you know, decision making. And we were junior lieutenants. So Paul was a first lieutenant captain, a newly promoted captain, and it was talk about that time at the basic school. We were really fortunate to be there with the guys that were there. A lot of people that listen to the program have heard a whole bunch of them. Your thoughts on being there at that time?
It's funny, I kind of liken it to a golden era. A lot of really great Marines had gone through there as instructors and went on to other things. But remember, 1980, 89 is when General Gray pushed maneuver warfare doctrine on us, and FMFM1 was written. And all of a sudden, all of these disenfranchised lieutenants and captains all of a sudden felt empowered by the doctrine and got all fired up. And there was a huge intellectual push at that moment. People started reading, which I fear is atrophied. In the intervening time, people were writing things. And so if that article served to spur discussion amongst junior officers, or better yet, amongst NCOs, it was good. And so there's a lot of creative thought that was put into the basic school, a lot of folks that have stayed in the Corps, to include yourself. I think it's all because of that experience of serving in Quantico at the basic school during about a 5 to 6 year period. It was really inspirational. And I'll tell you, Mac, as good as the basic school is today, we need to get back to that. I saw General Gray recently, and I gave him credit for keeping me in uniform for 32 years. And General Kelly, General Allen, Craparata, Osterman, Furness.
Not Craparata. Craparata always argued he was unscrewing you. He wasn't having a discussion with you. Mac, let me tell you where you've gone wrong here. Okay.
And the thing is, he's the biggest practitioner of the things that he likes to challenge. So he's a totally hands-off leader. He inspires people. He's competent. And, it's just funny to see, you know, a lot of people don't like being told. They don't like going with the flow. Whatever's, faddish, and Lou Craparata, and there's a couple others that fit that bill, they practice it, whether they preach it or not.
You know, what's been really fun throughout all of this is a lot of the names that you talk about, you know, we've crossed paths in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And to at one hand be on the theory end of it and talking and studying it and teaching it, and then years later to go practice it together was a lot of fun. When you were the CO of 8th Marines in Northern Helmand,
Second Marines, the Tarawa Regiment.
Do you know that they're? I just read a story that they're digging up Marines in Hawaii that were unidentified from the Battle of Tarawa.
Really?
Yeah, and because they believe now that they have the DNA capability to identify most of the sets of remains.
So, 5 years ago, when I was a public affairs director, there was a federal group that goes out there and does remains recovery. They found like 26 bodies on the island of Tarawa that were probably all Marines. And so I imagine what they're doing is cross-referencing the known DNA against these guys that they've found.
Well, they said that they're going to exhume, I think, 550 sets of remains from.
Right.
Yeah, so interesting. So you're CEO of Second Marines, but General Caparata and General Osterman, you're working for them and guys that, you know, you've known for 30 years.
Yeah. So my experience in the last 15 to 17 years, and maybe it's because the Marine Corps is kind of an intimate organization, but you go to war with your friends, the guys that you grew up with as lieutenants and captains, you've stayed in, you've done jobs. You maybe even thought after Desert Storm, you'd never see combat again. And all of a sudden you find yourself on the berm looking into Southern Iraq, and you're standing right next to somebody you've known for 25 years. Pretty breathtaking.
Well, and pretty comforting too when you can pick up the phone and talk to somebody that, you know, you have such faith and confidence in them across the board. And it's a pretty intoxicating place, especially when you're doing that and you watch the daily courage and inspirational behavior of Marines in combat. From Ramadi to Helmand, you've seen a bunch of it. Anyway, when people ask you to put that into words, how do you do it?
Oh, it's tough without sounding corny.
Right.
But you know, this is a labor of love if you do this for the entirety of your adulthood. And there's no way to talk to folks that haven't had the experience as to why you would make that investment and why you continue to do it, and you take assignments that uproot your family, and you live, especially if you're in the infantry, you live in the worst possible conditions, and yet you keep doing it. And I don't think it's because there's nothing else to do it. There's nothing else to do, rather. It's just the thing that defines you, and you want to keep getting it. And what's funny is having those experiences, a lot of folks have got out. A lot of folks, especially capable people like you, got out of uniform and then, you know, because it was imprinted upon you as a junior officer, you had to get a little bit more of that. And so you came back with a 10-year hiatus, if I remember correctly.
No, I only came back because you and Furness sent me an email.
So it's in your blood, you know, and I see it on recruiting duty. I travel across 1,500 sites in this country. I've got almost 4,000 people assigned to recruiting duty. And you get down to the cold corners of this country, and out of nowhere, you'll be in a coffee shop. Some older guy will come up to you, you know, with some sort of swag, you know, a hat or a jacket or something, just to identify that they've been in the Corps.
Right.
And when I'm with other service members, and I have a lot of respect for the other services, but they all point to the fact that nobody does that like the Marine Corps. And so it's easy to see why, when you sign up in your youth, why you stay at it for the rest of your life.
Good people. I read somewhere last week that we're also leading the league in most tattoos, according to tattoos artists. By far, the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor is the most tattooed emblem of any.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Of any service. All right, let's find out about you. Born and raised?
Hartford, Connecticut.
Hartford.
Bloomfield. Yeah, I knew this was coming.
I thought it was...
The Windsor Lodge, Bloomfield argument. Got it.
I thought it was East Bloomfield. Is it
yeah.
East Bloomfield?
Right. This is going your direction. It doesn't need to.
I was at the Kennedy domicile, by the way. I had heard so much about... first of all, let's talk... Okay, we'll get to it. Went to college where?
BU. Boston University.
Yeah, Boston University beat North Dakota in overtime. It was atrocious. The worst team lost. They got theirs the following day, though. I'm happy to say they're not going to the Frozen Four. Majored in?
I was a history major. Started life as a civil engineer and had to graduate on time, so yeah, I'm a history major.
All right, history major, storytelling, a lot of use for that in the world. All right, so how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
I come from a military family, but not all careerists. My grandfather was World War I on submarines. My grandmother was one of the first women in the Navy in World War I. She had five family members in World War II, to include my dad, who landed at Normandy. So we grew up with this narrative, and there was no predestination, but it was kind of, you knew you were going to go do that for some time. So my older brother joined the Army. I have another brother who's a police officer. And so it's kind of a culture of public service.
But were they officers? Were they enlisted?
Yeah, so this is what has colored my experience, is that they hated officers in my family. And I'm the only Marine out of my entire extended family up to this generation. And, I think Mo Kennedy was rolling in his grave when he knew that I put on a scarlet and gold. But, and so that was not the tradition. Most of them were not college graduates, with some exceptions. And so you kind of saw the world from that perspective of what it was like. You know, my dad's stories as a corporal during the Battle of the Bulge has a profound impact on how you view service and camaraderie. And maybe you seek to build that in your own experience. And so, you know, I went to school because they insisted upon it. And then I joined the Marine Corps because I wasn't, you know, I'm the middle child, left-handed middle child. I wasn't going to follow the family path.
You're that kid.
I'm that kid, yeah.
Okay. So, for the Marine Corps, why the infantry? Did you choose that? Were you awarded that? How did that work?
I mean, that's kind of, you and I know that is not the entirety of the Marine Corps experience. In fact, the infantry is not even the majority of the experience, but it's kind of how we brand ourselves. And most of our iconography is based upon a lot of infantry prowess and legacy. So I think that gets imprinted on you as a kid when you're out there playing war. It's hard to play pilot when you're 10 years old, but you can certainly play grunt.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, come on, aviation mechanic, it's not cool to play that, but you can play what you see on TV. So you become a grunt. Let's talk about, give me a couple people in your long, distinguished career. Give me a couple people that have made big,
Jim Jones was my first battalion commander.
Who affected you as a leader.
Yeah, so General Jones, and I really think he thought he could get me out of the Marine Corps when I was a second lieutenant, chasing me across the parking lot at the QB Point O Club. You know, but he had an impact. And here's a Silver Star winner from Vietnam, very dignified, very knowledgeable infantryman. We studied maneuver warfare before it was even coined as a, you know, by Bill Lind and all those folks. So he had a profound impact. And then on my next deployment, I had Anthony Zinni as my regimental commander. And he would hold court up in Okinawa every Wednesday and Friday. And you'd think that lieutenants that are bent on getting, you know, drinking and having dates wouldn't want to sit there and listen to old people talk about warfare. And yet you'd sit there for 3 hours a night and listen to these guys hold court. So that was kind of my foundational experience.
Wow.
And then we talked about the basic school, so that was my next assignment, and it's just kind of that has colored everything that I've done since.
I didn't know that the first time I ever saw Zinni was when he came and did his combat concept thing at the basic school.
Yeah, so every battalion that went to Okinawa
would have that
3-hour lecture. It was amazing.
All right, let's talk about your combat experiences. First time you go to war is?
Late in life. And so I was General Mattis's plans officer for OIF-1 and got kind of an intimate view of senior level decision making and the big muscle movements of the Marine Corps. Kind of out of my comfort zone at first.
So I want to ask you about that. This is the small group at that point. General Mattis is a division commander. John Kelly, who's now the Secretary of Defense, John Kelly, is Homeland Security, is the assistant division commander. A guy who will become a lieutenant general, John Tulin, is the G3 at the time.
Right.
Yes. You have Dave Furness, is he your assistant?
For the opening sequence,
right,
of the invasion. Yep.
All right. So Dave Furness, you have the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's a commanding officer of the 5th Marine Regiment. So in a small group, and then you have Craig Tucker, that's 7th Marines, yes?
No, Steve Hummer.
Steve Hummer. Okay.
Who just retired as a 3-star.
So that's the group that stands, that gets in a small group. What's
George Smith, who's the MEF planner, but a lot of times carried the lookout for the 1st Marine Division interests. He fought for us at much higher levels.
What was that like, though? That's the deep end of the pool. Intellectually, and let me tell you, you even as a junior officer, you can walk in and there's senior guys in the room, and you can quickly discern, whether you can swim in that end of the pool. But the guys we're talking about, are guys that will rise to national prominence because of their intellect, incredible intellect, and also because their experience. And what was that like as a relatively junior guy in that group to have to stand up and be the plans guy?
Oh, that's it braces you. when you got to stand up and brief General Mattis, I don't really, probably multiple times during the day on how the plan is developing. He'd sit in on our operational planning teams and give guidance, and it could be frightening. I mean, for the first month, I thought my career hung in the balance. And General Kelly loves to tell me that, or Secretary Kelly loves to remind me how close run a thing it was. But but here's the other thing with that entire list of people you mentioned. Every single one of them comes across as a pretty normal person.
Right.
So and even though General Mattis has attained a status, mostly about from people that have written about him. I question sometimes how well they know him. General Mattis is a people person first.
Right.
Like everything that he talks about is developing your subordinates, putting your arm around people, and motivating them by. And he actually says this: give them an extra hug if they're having a moment of doubt. Don't beat them down. And so
yeah, he'll save that for the officers. Okay.
Well, officers need it. Officers, right. Officers. Have chosen to live a differentiated life in this American experience, and they own up a little bit more than the rest of us. You get paid a higher tax.
That is a great summation of him and the way he looks at the world, because there's nothing that he would rather do than when we were in Iraq than to go out and do what he called battlefield circulation. But he wanted to go talk to Marines. He didn't want he didn't want a PowerPoint. He didn't want to see youth saying, in the Peloponnesian War, he did not want
to do
that.
That's the funny thing is he could do that. He could talk about history or intellectualize. But he always said that when you go visit a junior level, whether it's a company, a platoon, or you're at a squad observation post, they ought to leave thinking that you brought them something. Like they ought to be better for having had the experience. Now, if they're jacked up enough to get fired, then right. you obviously have that obligation as well. But that was a Madisonism, is, you know, bring something to them that they can't get themselves. And so, I mean, I try to employ that on this duty as well. I got recruiters who are the most overly worked Marines outside of combat. It's incredible. And so if you go in there and you're constantly taxing them, it's like, how can you beat on people that are trying to give you their all? So I applied that as battalion commander, regimental commander, brigade commander. It's imprinted upon me.
You go back to Ramadi after the march up. Well, give me a lesson learned from that whole experience as plans officer for the division on the march up. Give me a single lesson learned that stands out in your mind.
It goes back to what we were talking about with decision making. That officers are paid for their intellect and their character, depending on what echelon you are, your experience as well. And so General Mattis did not overanalyze or agonize, probably a better term, all the possibilities. He had a vision, and he gave it in a directed course of action. And that decisiveness allows you then to speed through the remaining parts of the process, which is the orders process, how you transmit down, giving subordinates time to actually do their planning so they're not jumping through hoops.
Right.
And so that was the biggest lesson, that you cannot optimize solutions in combat. You've got to come up with an 80% is probably optimizing. You come up with a solution that satisfies the needs of the problem, and then go. Because by the time you go, the other guy's acting as well.
Right.
And that his actions are obviously going to change your imperfect solution anyway, so get ready to make another change. That was the key. And we ran from Kuwait beyond Baghdad on Fragos, fragmentary orders.
Which is the real world.
Right. And so, I mean, to the point where at one point in the battle, we were up by Adibania, I think, and General Mattis is laying on his stomach scribbling out yellow canaries, which are a little memo pad, and we're transmitting that over the radio to the lead regiment. I mean, there was no fancy digital display and you know, a detailed matrix, and it was literally voco. Voice control.
Thank you. Paul Kennedy, Major General, United States Marine Corps, the Commanding General, Marine Corps Recruiting Command, joins us. You go back to Ramadi as a battalion commander of 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, Magnificent Bastards, and that was describe that in 60 seconds or less, describe that deployment. Thunderdome.
Yeah. Suboptimal preparation. So our battalion was at about 50% of its manning 6 weeks from the time we deployed, which means that you don't have the opportunity to train, develop cohesion, take those privates out of a very low level of training to, you know, an adequate level. But we didn't think the threat was what it would become. And, you know, as you know, Mac, it developed over time. The insurgency was just getting started just as we were hitting. I mean, it was probably started before we got there, but really in full swing when we hit Ramadi in the first week of March. And then it was game on. It was every single day. It was firefights. And
the big difference then, relative to now and even later in subsequent years, was we didn't shoot a whole lot of supporting arms into Ramadi or Fallujah. You know, it was close combat with Marines going out there every day.
Most of my casualties were lost by direct fire.
Right.
Which is, you know, not the experience that people had 2 years later, or certainly the experience in Helmand, where the IED was the principal weapon. But, you know, rifle fire, RPG fire was the principal killer of my guys.
Give me a lesson learned from that.
It's funny, with all the technology and overmatch that we bring onto the battlefield, when you get down to close combat, it's almost parity between you and the folks that we're fighting. And so a rifle squad in the modern era is has weapons that are familiar to his grandfathers, and that the bad guys in Ramadi, who a lot of them were also soldiers, they were disenfranchised from the Republican Guard and some other units that were local to that part of Anbar. They got the same weapons. They got AKs instead of M16s. They got RPGs, which is an incredible weapon. In fact, it's direct fire. It's a direct fire mortar is what it is. And when you're in tight, I gave this class in about 2 hours. I'm talking to the captains at EWS about this very thing, is that when you get in tight, you negate a lot of the advantages that the U.S. brings onto the battlefield. And that the kids that I saw in Ramadi were fighting with a lot of the key strengths that we rely upon in a combined arms fight. And we were not allowed to use tanks in the city because we didn't want to create another Fallujah. But artillery is almost impossible to use with any precision then. It's a little more fidelity today. And so you're fighting with your own organic weapons. And you better be pretty good. You better know how to shoot if you're gonna survive those encounters.
You go back as the commanding officer of 2nd Marine Regiment to Helmand. During that period, 3-5 is there, and their fight has been well chronicled. 1-5 follows them, 3-7 before them. You have a whole, I don't know how many different battalions rotate through while you're there. Give me a lesson learned from your experience as a regimental commander of the 2nd Marine Regiment up there.
I mean, the real lessons are the ones that nobody on this network is going to want to hear. It's all about discipline. Units will survive or become victims depending upon the quality of their leaders and the discipline that is enforced. That is really the lesson. But if you want to talk about combat lessons,
No. No, because let me tell you, it's interesting because that translates, because there's civilian, you know, Marines that are civilians now, and it translates to young people. You know, you and I have seen, you know, the millennials, right, and people have great discussion about what they can do. If they're given the appropriate structure, and if you teach them discipline, and General Kennedy and I are not talking about screaming and yelling all the time. That isn't
it. No, the opposite. Yeah.
It's loving them and teaching them how to be good, and then requiring that and watching them grow into that and embrace it, because they know that's what wins, and that's where discipline comes from. And so when you see that, that translates in the civilian world. It certainly translates in the Marine Corps, and it's how you win. You can't be successful in life without it. Oh, interesting.
So, you know, Mac, unless you explain it, and then it has to be contextualized,
right,
for the youngest members, because they're not coming from that tradition necessarily. So last year, a couple of years ago, I guess now, we had a reunion of the Magnificent Bastards, and we went out and had some drinks, and these are guys that are long since hung up the uniform. They're like, you know, sir, we thought you were a dick when you were making us shave and clean up. If our uniforms got torn or unserviceable, you know, putting clean uniforms on, we didn't get it. We didn't get this insistence upon pre-combat checks and inspections. We didn't get this insistence upon clear, you know, we used to go through these drills on clearing weapons, you know, and you come in and out of a fob. We get it now that you were saving us for this reunion, that the insistence upon those petty disciplines was in order to make us survive the experience. So 10 years hence, we could get together. I was like, man, there's the only return I ever, return on investment right there.
No, but it'll impact them on the rest of their lives, and as they go through communities and get involved, as they coach young people, they'll make them better. the I'll tell you a quick story. And I talked about it when the show started. I coached when we moved up to North Dakota. Patrick played on a Mite hockey team. A buddy of mine that I had met up there asked me to coach with him. His twin daughters played on it, Monique and Jocelyn Lamoureux. They are now members of and have been members of the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team for the last 10 years. They, because of their leadership experiences, because of the discipline that they learned, they were just primary figures in the women's national hockey team, taking on USA Hockey over gender equity issues relative to compensation and program funding and things like that. And to watch it, to see that, I mean, as you know, when people get it and then all of a sudden you see them on a stage, it's incredibly gratifying. But I don't, you know, I discipline, you know, it's the truth. One more and then we'll switch gears. You went down to the Philippines, after they had some bad stuff going on down there relative to weather and things like that. Talk about that experience, a bit different, more of a joint environment. Give me a lesson learned from that.
A lot of the same sorts of lessons go into humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. It's obviously not you're not bringing weapons in that sort of a fight, and you're not there as a military force, really. You're there mostly to provide wholesale level logistics. But you do go down a point to, you know, you're down at the point of friction. So even though I'm flying in big airplanes and we're moving mountains of supplies, it all comes down to corporals and lance corporals distributing aid to people that are in need. And so you realize that, a lot like in a counterinsurgency, it's all about legitimacy and the battle of the narrative. And so, and it's not even just your legitimacy, it's the legitimacy of the international humanitarian community, and it's the legitimacy of the host nation. And so I'm in a supporting role to both, rather than U.S. military leading. You're there to establish those legitimate, the view of legitimacy in those communities.
Right.
And so that was really, that was an adult lesson that I got. That you, just because you can go in there with the might of the U.S. military does not mean that you should be expending those resources. Because what it does is creates distortions, and it delegitimizes the very people that have to live with it after you leave. And so we did everything in our power to be partnered with the Philippine military. We did everything in our power to be partnered with USAID and International Red Cross and a bunch of NGOs. And you're winning hearts and minds. And you were there. I mean, if there's an American equity involved, it is – are being viewed by that country as a good partner, and that we come to them in their hour of need. And there were some players, some neighbors in that part of the world that came late to the game. And I'll tell you, they will be remembered in perpetuity for not having come in the Philippines' hour of greatest need, which is what I learned in Nepal as well. Same thing. So.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. I want to talk about recruiting, what you do for a living. I had Kate Germano on, and
yeah.
And you and I have had discussions about, and you made an interesting comment to me about the fact that I think we're beyond Kate's criticisms. So I want to talk about that. I want to tee them up, and then I want you to address them, because I don't think that part of this, the narrative of this, story. So, because I know that you understand your criticisms. I think the Marine officers that I talk to, they take them seriously. And where are we in this whole narrative? So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about online behavior.
Some of it will go back to what we just discussed, though.
Oddly enough.
At least those settings.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Major General Paul Kennedy, United States Marine Corps, head of the Marine Corps Recruiting Command, our guest here on a Wednesday edition, hump day, of All Marine Radio. More of that coming up next.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
.756 on a Wednesday, Mike McNamara with you, joined by a friend of mine for a long time, Paul Kennedy. He's a major general. Let me finish the introduction. He's the head of the Marine Corps Recruiting Command. Let's talk about recruiting. One of Kate Germano's criticisms is we do not target women that would be more suited in terms of mentality and physical skill for the Marine Corps. Talk to me about that criticism.
I believe probably from where Kate, from her experience, it might have been true. And I'll tell you, I recruited as a major up in San Francisco almost 20 years ago, and we did not apply the same techniques of systematic recruiting to our female prospects that we did to male. Because 95% of your mission was riding regular males. And when I say regular or reserve, those are the differentiations. So we didn't do it. And Kate, when she was a recruiting station commander, she was very good, and to the point that I just had dinner with some folks that worked for her when she was in San Diego that said, probably the most knowledgeable officer, and these are professional recruiters,
right,
the most knowledgeable officer they had ever worked with on recruiting. So she knows what she's talking about. Her experience, she tried to fix some issues when she was a battalion commander down in Parris Island. And I think she was onto something I think there's two problems. It's where do you recruit from? And then what are your expectations of those that you recruit? I think Kate wanted both of those addressed. And so let me just talk about the second part.
Okay.
That if you were finding quality candidates, males or females, but in this case women, and you have a certain expectation of them, they will usually meet that expectation. And so if the expectation is low, then they're never going to get beyond the minimum required. But if you establish your expectations and you drive them towards that, these 18-year-old women will do what it takes to succeed if you've recruited the right ones. So already you're seeing the things that that Kate identified. You're seeing progress in those areas. And so,
okay, so when you say progress in terms of you guys now evolve and screen, and I've never been a recruiter, so I know I'm using the wrong words, but you guys now apply the same standards in terms of screening and targeting females that you did for Marines, and you never did that in the past. When Dave Furness was on last week, he said, look, we recruited males, and in the course of recruiting males, you know, females would come up to the booth and we'd talk to them and we'd make mission like that. That's
right,
how it worked.
Which is not to say that you didn't have high quality women that were coming
in
20 years ago.
Right.
Just like I had kids coming, dropping out of college in Berkeley to join the Marine Corps, right? I mean, so you don't recruit out of a particular demographic. You get the best and you get some folks that are just marginally qualified. But okay, so we didn't use the techniques that we apply to men. And so one of the techniques, and I don't want to show too much leg here because, I'm sure the other services are listening and they are my competition. We use direct mail. Believe it or not, direct mail is one of the single best returns on my advertising money. And so a high school junior and then senior, they will receive a series of these personally addressed mail-outs. Well, we never use that for women. And so last year we started mailing out to women, and in 1 year they got 58,000 qualified leads. So it tells you that it's a proper use of your money. And so you've seen a commensurate drop in the statistics that typically identify recruiting out of a low quality market. So when they go into the delayed entry program, which is really, some people call it the pool,
right?
A high school senior or even a graduate will stay for a certain amount of time in that pool, and it lets them get themselves in order, lets them get their affairs in order. They get some physical conditioning, and they get socialized a little bit while they're there. And typically there's an attrition rate associated with that, that we've actually seen dropping like a stone, both in the male and the female markets. And so it's an indicator that we've found the people that, the right quality people that want to, see this process through. So they're not just joining and changing their minds a month later. They're joining and they're sticking.
And then
you have the next indicator is how many of them actually graduate. And so last year was the lowest attrition rate for women at recruit training ever. So, I mean, those are indicators that we've tapped into the right market. And the numbers haven't gone down. It's not like we're getting smaller in the Marine Corps. We're actually putting in as large a cohort as we've ever put in, somewhere between 35 and 38,000 kids a year shipped to boot camp, which is kind of counterintuitive.
You know, it's amazing. One of the things that was, I think, that surprised many people when the Commandant went in front of that the Senate Armed Service Committee to talk about online behavior was the demographics of the Marine Corps. What, 62% under the age of 26, and that 35 to 38,000 a year, so that we turn over 60% of the force every 3 years.
Yeah, it's programmed attrition.
I think those numbers are jaw-dropping. That much of your force turns over in that short a period of time.
Back to the discussions we had when we started, you need a young force to do the things that we ask them to do. And a lot of it's legacy, you know, the way the fire teams were developed during World War II and the expected numbers of casualties kind of dictated the size of the force. But today you find that, you know, when I'm a 48-year-old colonel, I'm hiking with the same load in the same places as 18-year-olds, you quickly realize that this is a young person's game. Now you get worn out, and if you do not have that ability to rapidly recover and get back out there on patrol the next day, you can't do that with old people.
Right. Doesn't work. Physically,
doesn't work.
Physically, it doesn't work. No matter how mean and nasty they might think they are, it simply physically doesn't work. So relative to her criticism of recruiting the wrong people, that when they get into the pool, there are lower standards for them, and therefore they achieve lower in terms of inventory, PFT when they report.
She's right. No, she's right. When she said that, she was right.
When she said that.
Not true today.
Okay. All right.
So when Kate was down at the depot, we did not have all the MOSs open to all sexes. So that obviously changed last year. We now have women that are signing up for infantry programs, and they have to meet the same criterion that the men do in order to ship to boot camp. And then when they get to boot camp, about two-thirds of the way through, they actually do a validation and have to show progress. They have to do 6 pull-ups. If they sign up to be infantrymen or artillerists or tankers, they have to do 6 pull-ups in order to go to the next phase. And so it's the same as the men.
And that has never been the standard. The standard for men was 3 pull-ups to leave recruit training. And I think when Dave Furness was on last week, he said in a study that was done, I can't remember what year, he said that if we would apply that as standard to women, 70% of the women would not have been able to do 3. and now you're talking about to be an infantryman. And I saw a, and I should play the audio from it because it's a great little piece that Voice of America did for, I guess, the first or a new female infantryman, infantry woman. Her name is Maria Domi. Is it
right? She's going to 2-4, my old battalion.
Is she? The have you seen the video?
I've seen some interviews with her.
She hammers this heavy bag like you don't want to deal with her. I mean, she smokes this thing, and she's an infantry soldier.
This is the new normal, though. This is what people don't understand. And I got it last year when I went out and visited the University of Michigan, and I have a friend that works up there in the football program. He's saying, hey, look, you got to start looking for the wrestlers in this country. And that female wrestling is got the fastest growth in any activity. And it's probably because of MMA and Ronda Rousey and those sorts of icons. And you go out to CrossFit gyms or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu dojos, and you see women getting at it. And they are incredible athletes. And again, the expectation was high, so they have met that expectation. So we go to female wrestling tournaments now. I am the official sponsor of USA Wrestling and the Marine Corps recruiting. We go out there and we see these athletes that are incredible. They are incredibly tough, incredibly fit, and they learn skills that will kick the shit out of most men. I'm not even talking about sizing them together. I'm talking about some of these women will kick the shit out of a 200-pound man.
All right, let me just play this audio, because if you haven't heard it, you need to. I posted it on the All Marine Radio Facebook page, but it's about 60 seconds. I just want you to listen to her story for those of you who haven't heard it, and then you got to watch this.
My name is Maria Dahl. I'm a United States Marine, and I'm an infantry motorman.
Move it!
I was born in a Siberian prison with my twin brother, and when my mom died when we were two, we got put into an orphanage. And that's where my mom and, well, my adoptive parents, Maureen Dahl and John Dahl, adopted me and my twin brother when we were 4 years old and brought us to the United States.
Sweet!
I want to be the best, and I like sleeping outside. I like doing, like, getting down and dirty. And I knew I could do it. Just because you're a female doesn't mean you can't do what a male can do. It doesn't matter who you are. It's your mindset and how much heart you have. I'm hoping that civilians or other Marines seeing me do this, that other female Marines and female civilians wanting to be Marines decide that they can do it too. I like to prove people wrong, and I know what I want, and when I want something, I go and get it, and no matter how hard it is, I'm going to keep striving for it until I get it. So I wanted this. You can say what you want, you can have your own opinion, but at the end of the day, when we get through it and we show that we can do the same thing as men can do, then there's no reason that, like, anybody has the right to say that I can't do it when I just showed you I can.
I'll tell you what, if you haven't seen that video, her name is Maria, M-A-R-I-A, D-A-U-M-E. Google it. You can go to the All Marine Radio Facebook page, and you'll see it there. Pretty compelling video. Pretty compelling video. She knocks a snot out of that heavy bag. She throws like three left hooks in a row that would break your ribs if she hit you with them. A pretty impressive young woman. So going back to the Kate Germano criticisms, and that you said were valid at the time, these things have all changed in terms of who you target, how they get treated at the pool. Then ultimately, how they show up certainly is different, and then what they achieve certainly different. Is that fair, or is that me drinking the Kool-Aid?
It's fair. How they are socialized in the late entry program has changed to a certain degree. It's always been very gender neutral. Even Catherine would admit to that. That the men and women are treated with very very similar. In fact, they're totally integrated when they're in the pool. Now we do some pool functions where women will have exclusive female pool functions where we'll bring female drill instructors and they can answer questions for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's they start live and they work together.
Her contention was because they were never targeted,
You were just happy to have them. They were only 5% or less of your mission. You were just happy to ship them, and it didn't matter the quality that they were. They weren't held to the same male standard of attendance and improvement. Your comment on that?
Some places that was probably true. I think that it's not a universal statement. I think that in 1997 or 98, when I was shipping women to boot camp, we had 3% attrition at MCRD. And so obviously we weren't just finding people that walked in and could fog a mirror. We were finding people that wanted to be Marines. And so I can't speak to her experience. I think that she is not, what she's saying is not untrue. It's just not across the board true.
All right.
Today, they were finding females of, I think, a different stripe. I'm not saying that they weren't always in our core, but some people that they did not incentivize female recruiting. They found people that, in some cases, just walked in the door, and they were happy to send them to boot camp.
Okay.
To meet a quota, if you want to use that term. But we're not doing that. And so we're actually prospecting for them, which means that we're targeting them for sales, so to speak, that we actually look for them. We want to have a dialogue with them. We want to inform them as to what their options are. And then if they meet our criterion that they will and pass the test, then they want to do it, they'll come in. And if you fish in the right ponds, you will find the people that will successfully get through the late entry program, successfully get through boot camp, and those that are bent on it will get through the School of Infantry. If you look in the right places.
Okay. All right. An email kind of takes us to the next place I want to go. Hey, Mac. Great hearing from the horse's mouth, and I love these interviews. Question for General Kennedy. Recruit training. Much has been made about it, the integration piece of it. I've heard women on your program talk about they don't want it to be completely integrated, that they think there is a need for them to have time to get their act together, so to speak, in phase one. I've also heard about the OCS model. I'm curious about General Kennedy's perspective in all of this. Integrated recruit training, in your opinion, what's the optimum design for the Marine Corps?
Okay, so this is more complicated, and not everybody's going to appreciate my response, but when we're recruiting kids, both men and women, you know, you're taking an 18-year-old, 17-year-old when we first encounter them, and there are concerns from the people that love them. And that the concerns is that they're going to be brought into a completely foreign environment and maltreated. And a lot of the worst sources of information are former Marines that served during Vietnam or other parts of our history that the experience was miserable. And so they're telling them how they're going to get beaten when they get to boot camp and, you know, just abused, you know, throughout their 4 years. So we got to go in there and we tell the parents, look, if we're going to become surrogates for your children, that we have to give them some confidence that they won't be treated that way. And a lot of the parents have particular concerns when it comes to their daughters joining what is viewed typically as an all-male organization, whether that's true or not. So, they like, most of the parents, most of the educators, the coaches actually like the idea of giving these women some period of where they can kind of get themselves up to speed in this typically male-dominated culture. And they actually like the idea of the initial training being segregated. But even in that initial training, about 60% of it is integrated. So that the rifle range together, they're at the pool together, they're doing the crucible together, it's not as though they're in a total vacuum.
Right.
They just don't sleep in the same barracks. And there are portions of the training that is segregated. But then they go directly to Marine combat training, or now they'll go to infantry training, and they're completely integrated. So they start life integrated in the delayed entry program. There's a period of segregation when they get to boot camp, and then they're integrated. And so that's the entire period of a session is graduation from MCT and ITB.
So when somebody takes a snapshot and say, hey, the Marine Corps is still the only service that doesn't have integrated recruit training, your response to that is?
It is not 100% segregated either. It's integrated during key portions, and by the time they hit the operating forces, they have been fully integrated. So I just think that there's got to be a period of, and there's got to be a recognition that young men and young women in this country are raised differently. And a lot of times you can't undo 18 years of social, I don't want to call it programming, but however this society treats young women, we've got to overcome that, because they didn't all come from wrestling programs, or they're not all boxers like the lady that you talked about going to 2-4.
Right.
Some of them were never asked to do those things. And so here's a period where they get to do it for a short period of time, and then they're brought into the fold. It's not popular, but that's...
Well, but again, the aim, though, is... The Marine Corps' aim is to create the optimum experience. Should it want to cave to public pressure and not design the optimum experience, that's easily done. Like, we can integrate the whole thing there. But intellectually, the Marine Corps doesn't believe that's the appropriate thing to do. Is that fair?
Using history as a lens through which to judge how you prepare people for success on the battlefield, I think that's exactly our rationale. And, Mac, the proof is, you know, obviously we're being plagued by some stuff that's in the media today.
Every college, every high school, every middle school, every grammar school in the nation is fighting the same thing.
So I just had a we sponsor certain sports leagues here on the East Coast.
Right.
And it was the presidents and chancellors from this particular group came together, and we had a dinner. And this is just when the Marines United thing broke. And one of the presidents pulled me aside and said, you know, you guys think you have it bad. We've got it 10 times worse in college. That all of those things that you're talking about of an inability to integrate men and women, because they're not integrated necessarily, even though they go to the same high schools, they have different experiences,
right.
And it's exacerbated in college, he said, because the people that have typically provided a guardianship are absent. You know, if you're living on campus, your parents aren't there. And so he says they have a higher incidence of sexual assault, they have a higher incidence of trolling in social media, they have the same ills that plague the military they're seeing in a college experience. And so, I mean, that's not an excuse.
No.
But it's happening in other places in this country.
Okay, so it's a symptom. So I want to link those two together. Do you believe that there's any, there's behavior at recruit training that, first question, do you own the recruit depots?
No.
Okay. What's your involvement in, do you have any, your relationship is that you provide the human capital that the recruit depot refines?
That's right.
Okay.
So the commanding general of Parris Island and the San Diego recruit depot, they wear two hats. They're the regional recruiting commanders.
Right.
In that case, they do work for me, and they are also the depot commanders.
And they work for?
And they're given wide latitude on both of those jobs.
And so as a depot commander, they work for?
They work for Training Education Command.
Okay, and that's General Lukeman?
Right.
Okay, and that's why there was a story out of Parris Island today about a court-martial and relative to the Siddiqui incident. And the General Lukeman, that's why you see Parris Island, General Renforth lining up underneath General Lukeman.
Right.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right. So talk to me. Do you believe that the way we do recruit training impacts the way male Marines look at female Marines? That separateness promotes a poor opinion, which then, you know, allowed to fester, promoted in some areas, then leads us to the online behavior that we see with Marines United.
Can it lead to that? Probably. If the same shitty leadership that allows hazing to go on, non-sexual hazing to go on in a platoon, probably also promotes that sort of misogyny. And so if you've got NCOs, and God forbid you have junior officers that are saying that to privates who are highly impressionable, then that is exactly what would happen. But I would tell you that Sparky Renforth's reports back to me, and he doesn't work for me in this regard, but he tells us that that stuff is just, there's zero tolerance for that. That stuff that happened, yes, 10, 20, 30 years ago certainly would have led to that. But like they are highly attuned to that today. That if they hear it, they squash it. Mac, it's expensive. It's what happens is if you promote that, if it manifests itself in behavior that is illegal, whether they're in the next phase of training or when they get out to the operating forces, and that person discharges either the perpetrator or the victim, then it's bad for business, so to speak. Like Marine recruiting is set back when we've got people that we have promised their parents and their guardians that we're going to take care of these people, and then they return with a negative experience. That's not good for the business. And that's strictly just talking from a recruiting point of view. We recruit these kids for life. And so why would you allow that to, if somebody that you have brought in to be part of your team for the rest of their lives, why would you give them that experience?
All right. No, I completely understand. Yet it continues. So next question. Do we need more classes in this? Do we need more education? How does this stop? And again, realize this, that Marines United, let's just say 30,000, what percentage is on active duty? Last I read, it was less than 1,000. The number people that access that hard drive was 500 or less. Blah 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 blah. I didn't see a breakdown of the number of people on active duty that access that hard drive. How does the Marine Corps put an end to that kind of behavior?
Well, it's not just. I mean, that's not the only.
And I'll take it back to discipline.
Pathology that develops.
Right.
It's all about proximity of leadership, and so it's the same problem with hazing or sexual assault or, you know, whatever. The further leaders are from the people that they're supposed to be in charge of, the more those pathologies develop. And so you talk about absenteeism in the barracks.
Because that's exactly where we're going with this. That's the next question.
Okay.
Here's the next question. I have a son who's a captain. I have another son who's a newly promoted first lieutenant. And then I have guys who email this program that are NCOs and staff NCOs. And they say, hey, look, we don't own the barracks anymore. We take them from the civilian world. And I want to get your response to this because you've been an area commander and you've owned barracks. That are now dormitories. And so the typical email I will get is, hey, you know, sir, things have changed in the Marine Corps. We don't own the barracks anymore. There isn't a company room layout anymore.
Yes, we don't want to go back to the squad base, right?
No, not squad base. They simply want to own them. They want there to be some law and order there. They want a field day done right. They want to go through and inspect it. But what we're told is that's their private area. We're not allowed up there.
Nobody has ever said that.
Okay, so let me just go on. So what they feel is there's a backslide back towards, yeah, I can be a civilian up here. The same rules that I learned and all that I went through to the Crucible, you know, that applies. But you know what? I have my rights. So
how many sports teams allow its athletes to just train themselves? Like you guys train at your own pace.
No, it doesn't work.
A coach has to get involved. So I had sub-area 2 down at Camp Lejeune, but at the time I was a regimental commander, the division deployed to Iraq. And so I was also took on the other areas. And I would walk around for 6 hours at a time, and I would get up on the third floor of a barracks on the catwalk, and I would just watch. And I would not see a single officer in 6 hours. And rarely would I see a staff NCO. And I have some corporal come up to me breathless, sir, what the hell are you doing here? You know, you don't belong here. I was like, yeah, I belong here. I own this place. And if you're not intrusive to a certain degree and show some interest in how they're living, how they're eating, what their hygiene is, then you should expect these things to go off the rails. And it's habituating them to never seeing you is why they resent you when you finally show up. And so I would just tell you, most people, they may complain about it, just like I talked about in Ramadi. Right. They complained about me enforcing those sorts of disciplines on them. And 10 years later, they said, sir, thank God you did that, because we were not going to do it ourselves.
Okay, so explain to me where this concept, because I heard it, I was only in with my broken time. I only served in male units. I served at the basic school, and we had female Marines go through there. But by and large, it's a male institution. And there was female support people on the staff. And then every other unit I served in, from sea duty, was an all-male, till I went to the MEF headquarters group, and I found out that I was living the anomaly. That's not the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps is the other 80%. That is mixed gender units that I didn't know a whole lot about it. It was like going to the zoo for the first time. Like, what? And seeing this world that I didn't really know. So my question is, and then in talking to junior female Marines, you know, and asking them on this program, is being sexually harassed simply the way it is? Yes, sir. It's the way it is. And I heard this concept of, no, that's our private space. You don't, it's just like a corporal living out in town with his wife. You don't go inspect him. You should come inspect us. Where did that concept come from?
I think 15 years of deploying, and in many cases, leaders not getting to know their people, because in many, like my particular case, you had a pickup team. Or you get back to Camp Lejeune, you get back to Camp Pendleton, you know that your folks have been through a meat grinder, and you want to give them a break. And the career force, staff and COs and officers, also want to have a break from it, and they want to go see their families, and they move on. And so it's a mistake. There was forced artificial conditions where people were living on top of each other practically in combat that I think you have an obligation when you get back to be even more involved, because a lot of those pressures and a lot of those opportunities to have very intensive, close supervision go away. So you have to force those opportunities. And we don't do that.
Right. And we don't do it.
It's a violation.
And the point being this, is when you allow that to backslide, and they can a la carte the menu relative to, well, I'm a Marine here, but, you know, once I get up to the barracks, those rules don't apply. This is where I live. And I can go online and be anonymous, and those standards don't apply to me here. It almost, and I hate to use this, but it's almost like this series of dominoes that if I'm not a Marine, and that's not me, that's not who I am, because I can pick and choose, then I'll choose this behavior. And so, I don't know. That might be complete bullshit argument, but I will tell you this.
Well, Mac, look, I just came from, before this job, I was a deputy out of 3MEF and the brigade commander. Now, the barracks at one of the camps had a lot of mischief going on at night. And, you know, there's always a duty on the first floor. Some poor kid had probably fallen asleep. So what they did was they put cameras in the hallways. They did not put them in the rooms, but they put a camera in each hallway of a 10-story barracks, with the duty and his A-duty monitoring. And there was a requirement to actually to monitor. And we saw the incidents of drunkenness and sexual assault or untoward sexual behavior drop, like precipitously drop. And when we ask the NCOs, hey, do you find this an invasion of your privacy? Is it Big Brother? They're like, well, you know, yeah, a little bit. Smacks a little bit of that, or a lot of it like that. But it gives me breathing space. It gives me a place that I can go back to, and I don't have to worry about somebody breaking into my room or encountering somebody in the hallway and people that shouldn't be there showing up. And it gave them a little bit of space to themselves. Counterintuitive.
Interesting.
And it works.
Well, no, it's almost like when you're raising your kids through high school, when you come home at night, you need to give either me or your mother a kiss. And if you smell like either mouthwash or whiskey, we're going to have a problem. That gives them an excuse to tell their friend, I can't. I gotta give Cuckoo a kiss goodnight in 90 minutes. I can't. And when they try to navigate those periods filled with peer pressure, those things, that structure, that discipline, if you will, is not a bad thing. Talk to me about
what about holding people accountable?
Well, that's that piece.
So you walk into the chow hall at Leatherneck, which I'm sure you did, and you see people paired up in the corners of the chow hall playing kissy face, and nobody corrects it. You see it right in front of your face. You see people with a rank differentiation doing that shit, and you don't go in there and intervene when you know it's wrong. And that fraternization leads to bad things. And so we are faced with all of these infractions, some of them really petty, that we just let go by. And when you stop enforcing all of those small disciplines, then the big ones manifest themselves. And I accuse myself and my peers of having an aversion to correcting people on the spot because you think it's somebody else's job. But I had a commander, Jerry Durant, you probably know him, and he said, if the colonel's not willing to get involved, then don't expect the corporal to get involved.
Jerry Durant?
You see something that isn't right, you fix it. Now, you don't got to tear a private a new one because they transgressed, but you go find his leader, you crawl up the chain of command, you find out why there was a disconnect, and we don't hold people accountable. We give them non-punitive letters, which to me is like toilet paper.
Yeah.
Fire some people.
No, thank you.
Don't fire people.
Thank you. Right? Thank you. And so we've had enough classes on online behavior and sexual harassment. And so the next piece is hold people accountable in a very public way.
Right. And not just some, you know, there were probably some junior people involved in this whole social media scandal. But there are people up the food chain that should have been monitoring that. They should have had a presence in those chat rooms and in those spaces, and that their failure ought to be accountable. And so if you want to stay away from the places where the junior Marines congregate, then you've abrogated your role as a leader.
So that's under everything your unit fails to do.
Yes.
And you should build, but you know what, again, the Marine Corps to me seems averse to that. And I know you can't comment on this, but I'll say it, and I've said it before. The whole, Siddiqui incident down at Paris Island, I have yet to see in a very public way, a commissioned officer be held accountable. Haven't seen it. I know people got relieved. But to me, until people pay, you want to get people's attention? Make people pay. Make it public and not just allow them to retire, but make them pay. And until you hold people accountable, you know, it's like Abu Ghraib. You know, I think a general got told to go home and then, but who went on trial?
Right.
Staff sergeant. They were just doing what they will always do when you're not there and you don't enforce the rules that you're supposed to enforce.
So guess what, Mac?
What?
10 years from now, we're gonna wind up at a point where the people that have allowed us to differentiate ourselves as the military, to live by a different set of rules, are gonna take away those privileges.
No doubt.
And, I mean, when you think about being a leader in the military, it's unnatural to the rest of the American experience in that you have one American that has powers over another one. In many cases, like in our line of work, life and death authority over people strictly because you're in the same organization. And it's a privilege that the American people allow the military to do that because there's military need. They recognize the necessity. But if you continue to abrogate, you know, your role as a leader, it's going to be taken away. And you look at other militaries where they've unionized. Over in Europe, they've unionized their military because they've squandered some of those privileges.
Wow.
That's my fear.
Wow. All right. Let me ask you about the
I only got a couple more minutes back.
Final question. The online, what's the bottom line relative to the online behavior that we've seen in the Marine Corps? Give me a solution for it.
I think I just spoke to it. You've got to be involved. You've got to be out there in those spaces. And so even though they're virtual spaces, if your presence is lacking, then you have no idea what's going on. It's like surrendering the barracks between the end of working hours until reveille. So get out there. And I will tell you that in my line of work, we do monitor those spaces because we use it as a vehicle for communication.
Right.
And so we have Facebook all over the country. Specific to some units, I've got it at my level, for Marine Recruiting Command. And so you're in those spaces, you're monitoring that conversation, you're participating in that conversation, you can help drive that conversation. And the beauty of the internet is that it typically will cancel out the noise. Eventually, disinformation and those negative voices will be drowned out by what I think is the correct. And what happens is it goes underground. When that happens, it goes to a different site. It migrates. So I'm just saying, get out there. There are a lot of people that view it as a liability. I view it as an opportunity to have a conversation with America.
All right. We'll have to do this again. I would love to have you back on and talk about your time in Ramadi as well as your thoughts on Afghanistan at some point. So,
sure.
So down the road, love to have you come back on. I appreciate the conversation, your candor. I know these aren't easy issues for the Marine Corps, but I agree with you. When a crisis is the opportunity for leaders to stand up and show what they're made of. I think there's a lot of institutions around the country that will watch the Marine Corps and the way it deals with this and use it as a model for their own behavior. And so, I hope we get it right. It sounds like we've made strides relative to the recruiting of women and that whole issue. And want to wish you all the best of luck in the future, and thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Mac. Thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. That is,
I'll be back in touch.
All right. Thanks, bud. That is Major General Paul Kennedy, United States Marine Corps, the head of the Marine Corps Recruiting Command here on a Wednesday morning. Interesting. You know, specifically, I wanted to get his thoughts on much publicized has been Kate Germano's criticism. And, so allowing him to talk to the specifics of how they recruit and how they're treated as a poolee, where they go and how those numbers have trended, I think is an important part of the conversation. So, and then I think, just to hear him say that the Marine Corps believes that we do this the best, right? That there is a period where we separate genders. Now, I would tell you the challenge is, if there are drill instructors that are bad mouthing anybody, that stuff's got to stop. That stuff's got to stop. So, again, my thanks to, Major General Paul Kennedy, United States Marine Corps, for coming on this morning, talking recruiting, talking gender equity issues, talking online behavior issues. You know, and it's funny that, when you talk to him, the answer comes back to what? Discipline and engaged leadership. Almost at every level, of that conversation. When I asked him about, lesson learned in Helmand Province as the CO of 2nd Marine Regiment, discipline. Discipline. When I talked to him about Ramadi 2004, he talked about a reunion that his battalion had and guys saying, we didn't get it then, but we get it now. All those little things instilled in us the discipline, the attention to detail, and all of that. So, interesting. But let me tell you, it is not a popular thing. And I'll tell you, the problem in the barracks in the Marine Corps is a big one. There are people that what he said, they don't believe. No, it's their private space. We shouldn't be in there. And I will tell you, it is wrong. It's bad for Marines to get that in their head. And there ought to be a diagram. You can put whatever quilt that you want to be that's respectful. Okay? And I don't even know that I care what posters you put up in your room, as long as they're respectful. Okay, but the room gets laid out like this. It gets inspected every Friday. Okay, I expect it to be clean, your gear to be stowed, and you to live in an orderly way that's representative of the Marine Corps. I don't think that's the way a lot of areas get run anymore. And I think that sows the seeds. I will tell you, and here's what I would liken it to. When your kid walks out the door and knows that there's a different standard, that I can't do that in my home, but when I'm either with this group of people or when I'm at school, I can act a different way. That is the road to hell for your kid. And what does that take? It takes a parent that's not engaged with the school. How's my kid acting here? And when a kid knows that the same standard doesn't apply and he can do different things in different settings, then he begins to pick and choose how he lives his life or she lives their life. And that is in terms of parenting, that is terrible for your kid. Terrible. I mean, for me, it was easy. I grew up corporal punishment, Kathleen, right? She was home. And then after that, I went to Catholic school. Report card night, it was always my fault. It was never the nun's fault. We did not have that discussion. And so to me, there's a parent. So you can see it in parenting as well. And then they come in the Marine Corps. They go through all that training. Now they go into the barracks, and we don't own them anymore. At least that's what I hear from all kinds of people in the Marine Corps. Yeah, that's supposedly now their private residence. That's bullshit. And that stuff needs to be stopped. Anyway, we'll take a quick break. We'll check some news headlines. Chris Woodbridge, the editor and publisher of the Marine Corps Gazette, going to join us as we do Marine Corps Gazette Wednesday here on the All Warrior Radio Network. And again, want to thank Paul Kennedy. Let me tell you, that's a hard interview to do for this reason. He and I are good friends. He's a funny guy, too. And we've had great conversations. He and I could do 4 hours of radio on decision making and teaching it and how you have to nurture it and how it should be done and the fun you can have, the fulfillment that you can create with junior Marines when you allow them to make decisions, to be a part of it. But I wanted to get his thoughts on specifically, I believe every person I talk to respects Kate Germano's opinion. And they said, you know, at the time, and I think his point was the most important. At the time she wrote them, you know, valid. We've changed a lot of that. And his point to me was, before he came on the air last week, was, hey, Mac, we've moved beyond that. We're now doing the things that she advocated. We are targeting, you know, his whole spiel about targeting wrestlers. You know, we sponsor that, you know. So I think that is so appropriate. But you know what? I don't know that the Marine Corps tells that story well. You know, I don't think they tell that story well. And so I think when you hear that, that integrated training to the greatest extent possible at Parris Island to border on the OCS model, is what the Marine Corps lean towards. Now, the next question is, can you still do those things and have them in the same company? And I think that you'll see one of the things that General Furness talked about was the Blue Ribbon panel that's looking at the entire pipeline from once you're recruited, becoming a pullee, to the time after Marine Corps, MCT, Marine Corps training, combat training, is that whole pipeline is being looked at now. Are we doing it efficiently? So it'll be interesting. So again, my thanks to Paul Kennedy for coming on. He is a, as I said, he's a smart guy, he's a funny guy, but he and 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, what they did in Ramadi, And I watched him because I was just across the river. I would go out and hang out with him on occasion when I was allowed to, which wasn't very often, but a couple times go over and be able to watch 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines. And we didn't shoot ordnance into the city then. And so they essentially got it on. Small arms engagements, RPGs, machine guns, and rifles, they got it on all the time. Every day they were there. And that stuff was rough. And they were awesome. They were awesome. And he had a great group of guys. You've heard a few of them. One you haven't heard, a guy named Chris Bronzy, who you need to hear, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps. He's a battle buddy times two, but he's a captain, company commander, won the Leftwich Trophy after that. And then there's another guy you have heard, J.D. Harrell, who you heard, most famous on All Marine Radio for saying, "Mac, you could put a shotgun to my genitals, and I don't know that I could pull the lever for either one of the presidential candidates." I think J.D. said that last October. So, anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll check some news headlines as All Marine Radio continues here on a Wednesday. Let me tell you, the reason when I created this and I had this idea, these kind of discussions that you've heard the last couple weeks, smart guys, tough questions, deep answers, footnoted, that was the idea of this whole thing. And in that way, attract, you know, people that are interested, that are Marines, that might be former Marines, that are interested in our culture. They hear, we're interested in these subjects and want to hear those kind of guys talk. And then when they're really not paying attention, tell them, hey, if you're having issues, don't quit. Hang in there. Whether it's the VA, the veteran service officer at your county, keep trying, keep plugging it in. Whether you get in touch with organizations like Boulder Crest Retreat and their emphasis on post-combat growth or post-traumatic growth, don't kill yourself. That was the concept of this. And so it's very cool after about a year to have guys like that want to come on the radio. And I will tell you this, the Commandant wants to come on again. They reached out and said, hey, you know, General Neller would love to come on again and talk about these issues. Because, again, you can hear, based on what you saw at that Senate hearing, and then when you hear them in longer format footnoting the truth and what's going on and where they still have issues, it's a much different discussion. It's a much different discussion. So I love doing this. And to be honest with you, they need to do more of this. They need to do more of this. So we'll do more of this. Max, email. Mac, you're fired up. Now, you know, I love this discussion. And it's a great organization, but it can't be led from the kneeling position. It has to be led standing up, and it can't be afraid. It can't be afraid. And more, I would say, of the DOD is afraid. It's afraid to stick its neck out. So, we'll take a quick break, some news headlines, and then Chris Woodbridge at the top of the hour. We're going to talk Marine Corps Gazette issues for March and April. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.